The debate over the fate of Confederate monuments has waxed and waned over the past century, with neither side able to claim what might be considered a clear and lasting, quote-unquote, victory. But this moment, following the murder of George Floyd and its approaching first anniversary, a sustained protest in response, the end of a particularly divisive presidency, and the beginning of another that offers a glimmer of hope, seems different, with a greater insistence that we hear the history and take decisive action. So what is the backstory of Confederate monuments? And can they be separated from the white supremacy and racial violence with which they're often connected? These are questions that are addressed in the new book, No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. It is by award-winning historian Karen Cox, a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. And we welcome Karen Cox to the roundtable this morning. Karen, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm happy to be with you today.
Again, the subtitle, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. What brought you, I mean, obviously what's going on in the world, but what brought you specifically to the subject?
It's actually a subject I've been grappling with for about 30 years. I wrote a book on the United Daughters of the Confederacy that came out in 2003, but I'd been studying it as a museum professional even before that, but the recent events, especially since the Charleston massacre of 2015, returned my focus to these statues, and obviously it's become a national conversation.
How important is that conversation, and ultimately, how should we be having it?
Well, I think it's the best way to have it is to have an informed conversation, as you would about anything. And this is, I think that what we find is that people are this is an issue that's divisive, like so many other issues that are divisive. But I think the best way to have a conversation is to be as informed as possible, to read as much as possible about the subject. It's something that obviously affects Southern communities, in some cases outside of the South. And so this national conversation is bigger than Confederate monuments. It's about systemic racism and white supremacy. And the reason that monuments were attacked last summer after the George Floyd murder was because those two particular ills of racism and white supremacy feed into police brutality, and Black Southerners and more of a plurality of Southerners actually recognize that that's what these monuments represent.
When you look at the idea that, as you said, you've been looking at this for so long, the arguments used to defend these monuments have certainly shifted over the last century. Give us a sense of those moments and the frames that we have seen and ultimately where we are now.
Right. Well, for several decades following the Civil War, when these Confederate monuments went up, and there were some, and every decade since the Civil War, we've seen Confederate monuments be built in this region. There was really, it was just an assumption that this is where what Southern communities would do. This is where they might place them. Although beginning in the 1890s, as Jim Crow was being legalized, you began to see these monuments land on the grounds of courthouses and state capitals. And so there was really no need to justify what they were doing. These white men were in power, and white women were supporting them in culturally through these sorts of statues, because women were behind the vast majority of these. It's interesting, later on, these monuments are often ritualized, and they are ritualized in the 1950s by speeches that are given next to them by Southern politicians who talk about anti-communism, or communists and communist threats, which is really a threat about civil rights. And more recently, the thing that we hear most often is that these statues are nothing more than emblems of Southern heritage. And when they say that, they're really speaking about white heritage, because they certainly do not represent Black Southerners.
That's right. And they often repudiate the connections with white supremacy and racial violence. History does not support that, of course.
Absolutely not. I mean, when we saw the you know, this boom period of Confederate monument building beginning in the 1890s, when the United Daughters of the Confederacy was formed, that decade was also a decade of intense racial violence, of lynching, and the disfranchisement of Black male voters, basically a repudiation of the 15th Amendment. And then you see, of course, during the early decades of the 20th century, once these things are on courthouse lawns, it actually happens to be a fact that this is also where lynchings often occur, on the courthouse lawns. And that's where the Confederate monuments also stand.
Karen Cox is our guest. The name of the book, No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. You spoke about this early on, but obviously the murder of George Floyd last summer reignited debate around the meaning and appropriateness of these monuments. And you argue that this, as you said, this debate stretches back to 1894 and to the organization called the United Daughters of the Confederacy. So let's talk a little bit about that organization and why ultimately they figure so centrally in this conversation that we're having right now.
Yes. So the United Daughters of the Confederacy, UDC, or the Daughters, are the primary organization behind the building of Confederate monuments between 1894, which is when they were formed, through the 1920s primarily. Things slowed down during World War I, and so the vast majority were built before then. And so it's, as I see it, you know, as men were basically instituting white supremacy into law, the United Daughters of the Confederacy was providing a cultural underpinning to white supremacy through monuments, but also through education of children, who they called living monuments. And they continue to be an important organization up through the time until the period of the Civil Rights Movement. And Confederate memorialization will die down after that, but it's picked up since the 1990s because of the rise of neo-Confederate organizations. The UDC has been very quiet in the last few years because they do not want to be associated with the kind of violence that went on in Charlottesville, for example. And they've really shut down. This is completely opposite of the kind of organization response that would have happened a century before. But they've been caught off guard, and it seems in some ways that they are not even aware of their own role in the preservation of white supremacy across the South through the work that early organization did.
You used the term living monuments a moment ago. Stone and metal statues, of course, one form of monument in the eyes of the UDC. So what else did they conceive of as monuments to the Confederacy? What are we talking about when we use that term, monuments?
Memorials are not necessarily monuments, but all monuments are memorials. And so you can see that, and memorialization might take place in the naming of a park. It could be street names, which we see across the South. It could be the naming of schools, public schools, and that sort of thing. And so there's a Confederate memorial landscape that extends beyond statues, although my book is focused, obviously, on the monuments themselves.
When it comes to the monuments themselves, and one of the things you write about, which I think is really interesting, is that Robert E. Lee became the focus of monument designers after Reconstruction. However, for his part, Robert E. Lee opposed the building of monuments. So, to both of those points, it comes the question, why?
First of all, he believed that monuments would keep open the wounds of war. Is the way he characterized it. But he died in 1870, and as the South emerges from defeat and emerges from Reconstruction, it takes on what we call the lost cause, which is this narrative about the Confederacy and you know, that helps white Southerners sort of deal with defeat. They emerge from that and emerge from Reconstruction celebrating the lost cause as a just cause. The Confederacy was a just cause, even if they were defeated. And then military leaders like Robert E. Lee emerge as heroes. And he in particular is what I call the Teflon hero. He seems to be untouchable in terms of all the Confederate leaders that existed, because he's the one who's most memorialized. There are some more monuments to Robert E. Lee than any other figure from the Confederacy. And the thing is even if he didn't want to be, he didn't think this was a good idea and he didn't want to see these monuments, the Lost Cause itself and white Southerners and their organizations of, Confederate organizations, whether they were veterans organizations or groups like the United Daughters of the Confederacy, that movement was bigger than Robert E. Lee, and they were going to do it no matter what. and that's exactly what they did. And it was a way of reclaiming for men, Robert E. Lee represents the ultimate, Southern soldier. It's a reclamation of white masculinity, but also stripped of the negativity and the stigma of slavery. Because they don't talk about those things when they're talking about memorializing or erecting monuments. It was the war wasn't about slavery, even though we know it was.
Karen Cox is our guest, professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and author of No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. You mentioned the Lost Cause narrative and how it gained such traction. But one of the things that's interesting is the forgotten role that the North played in that gaining of traction. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, the North basically capitulated to the Lost Cause. It gave in to the Lost Cause, that narrative, that the war hadn't been about slavery or that emancipation wasn't one of the most significant outcomes of the war itself. And a man like Frederick Douglass saw this going on and was, he made it his fight, I think, the rest of his life to try to maintain to fight against the Lost Cause narrative. He was in a losing battle. White Northerners really wanted to reconcile with the South, in a large part because basically the bottom line is capitalism and economics. They wanted an economic relationship with the South again. And in some ways, in order to achieve that, they would have to accept the Southern narrative of the war, in order to get beyond that. And so you see this taking place during reunions of veterans. But then you also begin to see it take place in popular culture, through Hollywood films, whether it was The Birth of a Nation all the way through Gone with the Wind. Many, many films that were set in the Old South aren't being made in the South. They're being made in Hollywood, and they're being written by Northerners in some cases. And so there's this since I feel like there's this cultural reconciliation that goes on between white Northerners and white Southerners, in part because they share similar beliefs about race.
So when you were asked the question of what should be done about this particular monument or that particular monument, do you give a standard answer, or does it really depend in your view?
I try not to get into the decision making of this controversy. What I say is this, and I've written a book that would make the case for removal. I'm not going to deny that.
Right.
But what I say to communities is that, and these are, first of all, we have to understand that they're very, most monuments are very local objects. They were put up by local groups, and they will be taken down, generally should be taken down by, you know, local government. And so it's that community decision that has to come. What we've seen, though, and is that state legislatures across the South have passed monument laws or heritage, they call them heritage protection acts, which has basically taken away local control and does not allow for removal. And so, my answer would be, you know, this is a community decision. You need to think about whether or not this statue in your community represents your community in the 21st century. And I think there, you know, that would be, for many people, it'd be a resounding no, but not everyone, of course.
You wrote an op-ed piece for an opinion piece for the New York Times shortly after the Capitol riot, in which you write, "Mr. Trump's feeble message to his stalwarts about going home and keeping the peace was similar in tone to General Robert E. Lee's admonitions in the aftermath of defeat. Quote, I think it wiser, he wrote, not to keep open the sores of war, but to follow the examples of those nations who endeavored to obliterate the marks of civil strife." Talk for a moment as we close out about those similarities, and as you say in the piece, the feeble nature of it and how it so readily exists in our culture now.
Yes, I thought, as I saw him, you know, the former president telling people to go home, and it resonated with me that this is, you know, that go home and you know, wait for another day or something like that. It just seemed really, it was sort of feeble, and it didn't have teeth in it. And it didn't seem like there was a real sense of urgency on his part that people should go. And I think similarly of Robert E. Lee. And so what I saw was this, it's like the rhetoric is there, the real belief and the action is not behind that rhetoric, and so we saw after the Civil War, and even as I said, despite the fact that Robert E. Lee says, well, you know, this is what we should do. I mean, what the complete opposite happened. You know, white Southerners actually started thinking about ways that they could justify the war and justify that they had owned slaves. And similarly today, it's like, well, you know, they felt, you know, the folks who felt that they were, you know, that attacked the Capitol and were supporters of the former president felt like they were justified. Like, he may be saying that, but what he really means is this. You know, it's and it's almost like, you know, they knew that he was basically speaking to the media, but not necessarily speaking to them.
The name of the new book is No Common Ground: Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. Karen Cox is the author and professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. The book is published by the University of North Carolina Press. Karen, thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the new book, No Common Ground: Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.